All right, listen, I want to pick up where we had left off in the second book of Kings. We left off in chapter 19. All right, but if you remember, when we were going through chapter 18 of 2 Kings, and also I hit up on a little bit in Isaiah and a little bit in Chronicles, in a situation where the southern tribe of Israel has one of the best kings they've ever had, apart from David, and that's Hezekiah. And he had a notoriously wicked father named Ahaz, and Hezekiah turned out totally different, and I think that a lot of that could be attributed to the fact that he very likely had a very godly mother, and she raised him up in the love and knowledge and fear of God. So when Hezekiah became king, he made all these reforms, all right? His father closed up the temple and set up all kinds of idol worship, and set up a false altar right there in the court area where God had him have the brazen altar. Anyway, his father did so many notoriously wicked things, and here this guy turns out so good because he reversed everything his father did, and he got rid of all of the idolatrous practices and all of the places where people would worship on the high places. And this guy was just exceptional. And God was prospering him and blessing him left and right. Now, here's the situation. God had already incarcerated away the northern kingdom because of their wickedness and their evil and their idolatry, and they got into Baal worship, and they didn't have one king up there in the north that was any good. And so God just finally had enough of them, and they just says, okay, he brought down Sennacherib, who was the king of Assyria. He came down and destroyed the whole northern kingdom and incarcerated away all these people, his people, God's people, because of their wickedness. But God spared the southern kingdom because they hadn't gone so far as their idolatry and rebellion against God. And then they have this godly king comes on the scene, makes all these reforms, reverses everything his father did, and then it comes around that in spite of the fact that all he did to glorify God, he still has problems. In other words, the king of Assyria now is eyeballing the southern kingdom and now wants to come down there and overrun it. And sure enough, he came down there and started, destroying a lot of the villages and the cities that were around Jerusalem. And what Hezekiah did, I think he made a big mistake. We read about this last week in chapter 18. He figured he could buy off Sennacherib, or he felt like he could buy off the king of Assyria. So what did he do? He got together all the gold that he could out of his temple treasury, out of his treasury, the palace treasury, and then he took it out of the temple treasury, and he even took off the gold that Solomon had put on the doors inside the temple, and he sent him to the king of Assyria, to placate him. And, he figured he could buy him off. Long story short, the king took all this ransom money, all this gold, and the king said, we're going to overrun you anyway. And so the thing I think that God tried to really point out in this episode here is that Hezekiah didn't seek God's face in this situation. Instead, he relied upon his own resources. He figures, this seems like the expedient thing to do. And last week, I was really trying to emphasize how important it is that we understand. I mean, I live by this scripture verse, to trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely upon your understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge Him. Acknowledge God, and He will direct your path. That's Proverbs 3:5. All right. That's what Hezekiah failed to do. He figured that he could handle the situation, so God just let him do it until he got to the situation where now he's got nowhere to go but down on his knees, nowhere to look but up. I mean, he's got no recourse. And this is where this story picks up, and I just wanted to give you that overview, especially for the people who weren't here last week. Beginning at verse 1 of chapter 19, it says, "And when King Hezekiah heard it, he tore his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth and entered the house of the Lord." Now, see, this is what he did. Now he's got no other recourse. Like I said, a lot of times I think we could do this as Christians. We come up with difficulties and situations and circumstances in our life, and rather than look to God and seek God right up front, right in the beginning, we think we can handle certain things or situations or circumstances until we finally are painted into a corner where we got nowhere to go but down on our knees and nowhere to look but up. I mean, isn't this the way it is with not just Christians, but even non-Christians? I mean, you can't be bothered to give God the time of day until really there's nowhere to go but down on your knees. Well, here Hezekiah realizes, man, there's nothing I could do but turn to God now. And, God's not proud. He'll stoop to conquer. I mean, how many times, like Jesus said in the New Testament, he says, hey, I am the vine, you are the branches, and apart from me, you can do nothing. And we got to get through our thick skulls sometimes. And you know what? We got to rely upon God in every situation. Well, now it says here, he entered the house of the Lord. Then he sent Eliakim, who was over the household with Shebna, the scribe, and the elders of the priests, and covered with sackcloth to Isaiah, the prophet, the son of Amos. Now, he should have done that right up front, right? It's almost like a last resort. Now he goes in, he's praying, he's seeking God's advice, he's sending his people over there to talk to Isaiah the prophet. And in verse 3 it says, "And they said to him, thus says Hezekiah, this day is a day of distress, rebuke, and rejection, for children have come to birth, and there is no strength to deliver." In other words, what he's basically saying to Isaiah is that we're like a woman who's due as far as delivery is concerned, and she's has absolutely no strength to deliver the baby. I mean, they recognize, hey man, they're at the end of the rope. There's nothing they can do in this situation. So they're seeking God out. Like I said, this is instructive to me because we all have a tendency to just simply ignore God until there's nowhere else to go, nowhere else to look, you know. And then he says in verse 4, he says, "Perhaps the Lord your God will hear all the words of Rabshakeh, whom his master, the king of Assyria, has sent to reproach the living God, and will rebuke the words which the Lord your God has heard. Therefore, offer a prayer for the remnant that is left." So the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah, and Isaiah said to them, "Thus you shall say to your master, thus says the Lord, do not be afraid because of the words that you have heard, with which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me." Now look what he's saying here. Okay, what are these people doing? I mean, what are these enemies of God doing? I mean, they're persecuting God's people. But what did Jesus say to Saul on the way to Damascus? He said, "Saul, Saul, why dost thou persecute me?" All right? Mm-hmm. Even though Saul was running around and he was persecuting all the Christians and having them thrown in prison, you know, and having them tortured and all these type of things. I mean, Jesus said, "You're persecuting me." And this king of Assyria, he's blaspheming God. I mean, God's taking it personal here because he says in verse 6, he says, "Isaiah said to them, thus you shall say to your master, thus saith the Lord, do not be afraid because of the words that you have heard, with which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Behold, I will put a spirit in him so that he will hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will make him fall by the sword of his own hand. Then Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria fighting against Libna, for he had heard that the king had left Lachish. When he heard them say concerning Tihathka, the king of Cush, behold, he has come out to fight against you, he sent messengers again to Hezekiah, saying..." Now, before I even go any further here, look at this king of Assyria. Mm-hmm. He's down here, and it says he was over there in fighting against Libna, and then he turned around, and he's fighting against Lachish, and now the king of Cush, I guess the king of Ethiopia, is coming against him. This guy's all over the board. If you look down here, you can see Lachish down here, and you can see Libna here. Libna's probably about 5 or 6 miles from Jerusalem, and Lachish is maybe 10, 15 miles at the most. But he's been all over Jerusalem, you know, just ransacking the whole place. This guy is just driven by greed, by power, by the lust for, you know, confiscating everybody else's goods, this type of thing. And the Assyrians were just notoriously wicked people. I mean, they were ruthless. I mean, I read situations where they would decapitate people and impale their heads on poles and then flay them alive or skin them alive. And this guy was just absolutely ruthless. Nobody could stand against him. Nobody. Everywhere he'd go, you know, he was victorious. And it says here, in verse 10, it says, "Thus you shall say to Hezekiah, king of Judah, do not let your God, in whom you trust, deceive you, saying, Jerusalem will not be given into the hands of the king of Assyria. Behold, you have heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all the lands, destroying them completely. So will you be spared? Did the gods of those nations which my father destroyed deliver them, even Gozan and Haran and Repseth and the sons of Eden, who were in Telazar? Where is the king of Hamath, the king of Arphad, the king of the city of Sepharvaim, of Hena and Iva?" He says, "Then Hezekiah took the letter from the hand of the messengers and read it, and went up to the house of the Lord and spread it out before the Lord. Hezekiah prayed before the Lord and said, O Lord, the God of Israel, who are enthroned above the cherubim, you are the God, you alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see, and listen to the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to reproach the living God. Truly, O Lord, the kings of Assyria have devastated the nations and their lands, and have cast their gods into the fire, for they were not gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. So they have destroyed them. Now, O Lord, our God, I pray, deliver us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you alone, O Lord, our God." Now, look what this guy does. Now, you see that this guy is, you know, really knows how to pray. He brings this letter, this threatening letter, demanding that they surrender to this godless king, and he brings it in before the Lord, and he spreads it out before God, and look at how he prays. Because remember when the apostles asked Jesus how to pray, and Jesus said, this is how you pray. You say, "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done." And you look at his prayer here, you can see almost a template for that, can't you? Because of that verse 15, Hezekiah prayed before the Lord and said, "O Lord, the God of Israel, who are enthroned above the cherubim." In other words, he's above the cherubim. The cherubim were what? What's he talking about? No, he's talking about the Ark of the Covenant. Remember, on the Ark of the Covenant, there were two angels, two cherubim, that looking down at the mercy seat, and God was enthroned above the cherubim there. Now, that's very significant. That's very important, because the Ark of the Covenant, what did it contain?
Manna,
it contained it contained a jar of manna. It contained the Ten Commandments, and it contained Aaron's staff. All right, and the lid of the mercy seat, that's where the angels, the cherubim, were looking down on that lid. That's where the blood was sprinkled. And so God would dwell above the cherubim, and he would be looking down, and he had to see the blood. What was the blood covering? It was covering the Ten Commandments, meaning that everywhere that we break God's laws, all right, if the blood is covered over that, everywhere that we break his moral laws, we can be forgiven. Mm-hmm. Everywhere that we spurn God's provisions, you know, look at how many ungrateful pigs there are today running around today. I mean, even in a church, how many people really, really thank God? I mean, when's the last time you thank God for your eyesight, for your health? I've said this many times. I said, is there one thing in life that you would not be willing to give up for $1 million? Would you be willing to give up your eyesight for $1 million? Or your hearing, or the use of your legs, you know, or what? Your children? What would you be willing to give up for $1 million? If there's just one thing, then you're a millionaire. You know, but we don't think in those terms. A lot of times people just don't give God the credit, the honor, the glory, the thanks, the appreciation, spurning his provisions. That's what that manna represented, because manna, God was giving the manna to the people, and the people came to loathe it. They said, "We're sick and tired of this insipid manna. We're fed up with it." You know, they wanted meat to eat. So in other words, they didn't appreciate what God was doing for them, right? Mm-hmm. What did that manna symbolize? What did it point to?
Jesus Christ.
Jesus said it in the Gospel of John. I think it's the 8th chapter Jesus talked about. He says, "I am the manna that came down from heaven." And Jesus said this, "I am the bread of life." He said, "I am the living water. Whoever drinks from me will never thirst again. And as the bread of life, whoever feeds upon him will never hunger again." And I've been a Christian almost 35 years, and I've seen a number of people throughout the years who've come to Christ, and they've had a good cry, and they've accepted him. But then now, where are they? You know, a few weeks, a few months, a few years later, they're back doing the same old thing. And you wonder, well, if Christ is so satisfying, how come these people couldn't find their satisfaction in him? How come they're not going to church anymore? How come they're not attending Bible study or prayer group? How come they're just sitting in front of the TV 58 hours a week if Christ is so satisfying? And the reason is because they don't feed heartily enough upon the manna, the bread of life, God's word. They don't drink deeply enough from Jesus Christ. They don't spend enough time in prayer. Because I guarantee you spend quality prime time with God in prayer every single day, you will find your satisfaction in him. Even if you're going through dry, arid periods, you keep at it. You keep reading his word. You keep praying. You keep going to Bible study. You keep on feeding, and you will find your satisfaction in him. And what was the other thing? It was Aaron's rod in there. Everywhere that we spurn God's authority, I don't care whether it's your parents, whether it's the civil authorities, whether it's the governmental authorities, or whether it's your religious authorities, everywhere you revolt against them, it's an offense against God. So these three categories cover all the sins that men commit. But God is dwelling above the cherubim. He's looking down, and if it's covered with the blood, we can be forgiven. That's where God dwells. That's what he's looking at, the blood. So that he's talking about the one who dwells above the cherubim. In that verse 15, Hezekiah prayed before the Lord and said, "O Lord, the God of Israel, who art enthroned above the cherubim, you are the God, you alone of all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth." Isn't this what Jesus said? "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." And you know who you're addressing. There's a whole pantheon of gods that people are addressing today. It's got nothing to do with the God of heaven. Now, one of the biggest, to me, forms of blasphemy today is saying, well, I'm God, or I'm part of the divine spark, or I'm one with the cosmos, or I'm one with the universe. So, you know, I mean, it goes on and on and on, right? You know, it gives you a headache thinking of all the things that people say. Hey, you know, we're dealing with a personal God here. right? And it's the God who created the heavens and the earth. There's no one higher, all right? There's no appeal after him, because that's what he's saying here. You have made the heavens and the earth. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see, and listen to the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to reproach the living God. He's praying in a very, very powerful way, isn't he? Mm-hmm. He's not saying, oh, Lord, deal with these wicked people, you know, because we're so good. No, he's saying this, you know, this man needs to be dealt with because he has reproached you. Look at all the people that are reproaching God today. They're poking fun at God's people. They're making fun of the Bible and Christians, but they're really poking their finger in God's eye. In verse 17, truly, O Lord, the kings of Assyria have devastated the nations in their lands and have cast their gods into the fire, for they were not gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. So they have destroyed them. Now, O Lord, our God, I pray, deliver us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you are alone, O Lord, our God. Now the guy really knows how to pray. He should have done this right up front, but this is the last resort. But now, you know, God's hearing him. Now look at verse 20. Then Isaiah, the son of Amos, sent to Hezekiah, saying, thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, because you have prayed to me about Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, I have heard you. See? That's what he should have done right up front. All right? But prayer was the last resort, but God is gracious, and he says, okay, I've heard you. In verse 21, this is the word that the Lord has spoken against him. Now, if you read Isaiah chapter 37, the whole chapter of Isaiah chapter 37 is identical to this chapter 19 in 2 Kings. Identical. The only difference is I think there's 37 verses in this one, and there's 35 verses in Isaiah chapter 37. But it's the exact same words, verbatim, of this chapter. So it begins at verse 20. It says, and Isaiah the son of Amos sent to Hezekiah, saying, thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, because you have prayed to me about Sennacherib, king of Assyria, I have heard you. This is the word that the Lord has spoken against him. She has despised you and mocked you, the virgin daughter of Zion. She has shaken her head behind you, the daughter of Jerusalem. Now, you know what? Just bring it up to date. Look at all the people who are mocking Christians, who they scoff and they mock at them, they ridicule them, they forever. Well, who are they really doing it against? In verse 22, whom have you reproached and blasphemed? And against whom have you raised your voice and haughtily lifted up your eyes against the Holy One of Israel? Through your messengers you have reproached the Lord. You have said, with my many chariots I have come up to the heights of the mountains, to the remotest parts of Lebanon, I cut down its tall cedars and its choice cypresses. In other words, he's cut down everybody who stood in his path. He didn't literally cut down trees and cypresses, but he cut down everybody who opposed him. And I entered his farthest lodging place, its thickest forest. I dug wells and drank foreign waters, and with the sole of my feet I dried up all the rivers of Egypt. Have you not heard? Long ago I did it. From ancient times I planned it. Now I have brought it to pass that you should turn fortified cities into ruinous heaps. Therefore these inhabitants were short of strength. They were dismayed and put to shame. They were as a vegetation of the field and as the green herb, as a grass on the housetop is scorched before it is grown up. In other words, what he's saying here is he's saying that you know, God was using the king of Assyria. He was using him to chastise all the wayward nations, and he was using them as a disciplinary scourging rod against the northern tribe of Israel. But now it's come full circle. All right, now it's come full circle, and it's time for him to be judged. You see, what does Peter tell us? He says judgment begins where? In the house of the Lord. God will deal with his own people first, but then he'll turn right around and deal with the wicked people too. And verse 27 is, but I know you're sitting down and you're going out and you're coming in and you're raging against me. Because of your raging against me and because of your arrogance has come up to my ears, therefore I'll put my hook in your nose and my bridle in your lips, and I will turn you back by the way which you came. Then this shall be the sign for you. You will eat this year what grows of itself, and in the second year what springs from the same, and in the third year sow and reap and plant vineyards and eat their fruit. The surviving remnant of the house of Judah will again take root downward and bear fruit upward. For out of Jerusalem will go forth a remnant, and out of Mount Zion survivors. The zeal of the Lord will perform this. And basically what he's saying is this. He's saying to Hezekiah through Isaiah the prophet, he's saying, okay, the land has been devastated by the armies of the Assyrians, but God's saying this, I'm going to provide for you. He's saying here that you will eat this year what grows of itself, and in the second year, what springs from the same. In other words, even though your land's been devastated and they've confiscated everything, God's still going to provide for you. All right? And this will be a sign to you that he hasn't forsaken you. He hasn't abandoned you. He's going to care for you, even though everything looks bleak at this point. And then verse 32, it says, therefore, thus saith the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he will not come to the city or shoot an arrow there. He will not come before it with a shield or throw up a siege ramp against it. Now that's exactly what he said he's going to do. Exactly. Right? But God says, no, I got other plans for this man. And verse 33, by the way that he came, by the same way he will return, he shall not come to this city, declares the Lord. For I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and for my servant David's sake. See, that's the thing. It's not that these people deserve to be saved. In other words, God will do it for his own sake. You know, when he makes a promise, he'll see it through. Because he can swear by no one greater than himself. And at the same token, you got to look at a situation where, hey, none of us are in a situation where we could say, hey, God, you owe me. You know, if we start keeping accounts with God, we are forever going to be so far in debt as to be bankrupt, morally bankrupt. We can't say, well, God, you know, I've done so many things for you. I've taught Sunday school for so many years and you owe me. Or I've been such a good person, this type of thing. No, that's not the way to approach God. God says this, I'll do it for my name's sake. When we look to God in prayer, we pray in Jesus' name. We got to trust in him and believe in him. That's the way to pray. In verse 35 it says, then it happened that night that the angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when the men arose in the morning, behold, all of the men were dead. Now look at this. Who's the angel of the Lord?
Jesus.
It's the pre-incarnate Christ, because, you know, it's not talking about here an angel of the Lord, but the angel of the Lord. Now, Jesus Christ is not an angel. You know, I know that Jehovah's Witnesses say that he's Michael the Archangel incarnate, but that's heresy, all right? Virtually everywhere you will see in the Old Testament, I don't care whether it's in Samuel, whether it's in Judges or other places, wherever that title is given, the angel of the Lord, well, you could look at the context, and the context is talking about God. All right? Mm-hmm. And that's why it says the angel of the Lord, you know, it was the pre-incarnate Christ, went through and destroyed 185,000 of the Assyrian troops. And in the morning, they were all dead. Mm-hmm. And in verse 36, it says, so Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived in Nineveh. And it came about as he was worshiping in the house of Nishrosh, his god, that Adramelech and Shaezer killed him with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Ararat. And Esharhaddon, his son, became king in his place. He goes home with his tail between his legs. He goes home completely defeated and humiliated. And he gets home, he starts worshiping in the temple of his God, and his own son kills him. I mean, this was his end. All right. Now, what did he have to show for it? He went through conquering all the known world, you know, just devastating people left and right, and look at his end. History is just strewn with the wreckage of people who have just been driven by power, by the lust of conquering other people. And, you know, where are they now? I don't care whether it's the Hitlers or the Stalins or the Mussolinis or the Napoleons or the Caesars or, you know, all throughout history. You can see one despot after another, they may rise to power in such a way you think that, man, these people are going to be entrenched forever. But when their time is up, their time is up. And look, I think it's almost poetic justice. He put all his trust in his gods, and he's killed right there in a temple of his gods. What does that tell you? You know what I'm saying? Okay, well, listen, I want to go through this chapter 20 real quick, because I want to tie the two together, because right after this episode happens, okay, this is right around the same time, Hezekiah falls really ill and sick. And I wanted to tie it in with how God gave him this great victory, because once God gave Hezekiah this tremendous victory, all right, then he became known worldwide as far as the known world at that time, because, you know, the king of Assyria was so dreaded by every nation. And then it looks like people were all giving Hezekiah the credit for this, because they think, well, he defeated this king. Well, it wasn't Hezekiah that did it. Obviously, it was God that did it. All right. And, you know, even Josephus mentions this particular episode and says that Hezekiah kind of got puffed up about this, all right, which is kind of unfortunate. But anyway, beginning at verse 1 of chapter 20, it says, in those days Hezekiah became mortally ill, and Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos, came to him and said to him, thus saith the Lord, set your house in order, for you shall die and not live. Then he turned his face to the wall and prayed to the Lord, saying, remember now, O Lord, I beseech you, how I have walked before you in truth and with a whole heart, and have done what is good in your sight. And Hezekiah wept bitterly. Before Isaiah had gone out of the middle court, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, return and say to Hezekiah, the leader of my people, thus saith the Lord, the God of your father David, I have heard your prayer, I have seen your tears. Behold, I will heal you on the third day that you shall go up to the house of the Lord. I will add 15 years to your life, and I will deliver you from this city from the hands of the king of Assyria, and I will defend this city for my own sake and for the, my servant David's sake. Then Isaiah said, take a cake of figs, and he took and laid it on the boil, and he recovered. Now Hezekiah said to Isaiah, what will be the sign that the Lord will heal me, and that I shall go up to the house of the Lord the third day? And Isaiah said, this shall be the sign for you from the Lord, that the Lord will do the thing that he has spoken. Shall the shadow go forward 10 steps or go back 10 steps? So Hezekiah answered, it is easy for the shadow to decline 10 steps. No, but let the shadow turn backwards 10 steps. Isaiah the prophet cried to the Lord, and he brought the shadow on the stairway back 10 steps by which it had gone down on the stairway of Ahaz. Now, the reason I added that for is because this is one of the most fascinating chapters that you ever read in scriptures, and because, in my opinion, it reveals one of the most incredible miracles that is recorded. It's just absolutely phenomenal when we begin to look at what he's saying here. Because, well, first of all, you back up, and we're just talking about what happened to Hezekiah. It was around the same time, and God says, okay, get your house in order. You're going to die, because it says that Hezekiah became mortally ill. And from the writings of like Josephus, I mean, all the physicians and everyone had given up total hope for him. And God just said it was time for him to go. But he turns around, and he turns his face towards the wall, and look what he says in verse 3. Remember me, O Lord, and beseech you how I have walked before you in truth and with a whole heart, and I have done what is good in your sight. And Hezekiah wept bitterly. And Josephus, what he says is one of the reasons why Hezekiah was so distraught is because it says that Hezekiah didn't have a son at this time. He had no one to pass on his name and his kingdom. And, you know, he had worked so hard for the Lord, and labored so hard, and he did so much in terms of turning the nation around back to God, and now, you know, God was going to take him. But, and it says he wept bitterly. But you know what's kind of interesting? In the Psalms, it says that God saves all our tears in a bottle. How many tears do you think have been shed since the fall of mankind on this planet?
Billions.
Billions, trillions probably, right? And it says that God saves all our tears in a bottle. You know, in a sense, and in Revelation, it says that God will wipe away every tear. God allows, you know, so many things to happen that we don't have answers for. Here Hezekiah just doesn't have an answer for. It just seems so unfair after everything he's done, and he comes to God, and he's really distraught. So, you know, he moves God, and God decides, okay, I'll add another 15 years to your life. However, I don't want to get into this because we'll get into it next week, but God knew what he was doing, because Hezekiah ended up begetting a son who became a notoriously wicked man. Mm-hmm. His name was Manasseh, and he undid everything that Hezekiah had done. Mm-hmm. And he basically, Hezekiah, you know, begat a devil. I mean, you know, so God knew what he was doing, but God was merciful to Hezekiah. So he says, okay, you know, I'll give you 15 years to your life. Mm-hmm. He says in verse 4, but before Isaiah had gone out of the middle court, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, return and say to Hezekiah, the leader of my people, thus saith the Lord, the God of your fathers, I have heard your prayers, I have seen your tears, behold, I will heal you. You know, that's one thing I've felt it many times in my life, when you just feel like, man, where is God in my life? I mean, my prayers just seem to bounce off the ceiling and ricochet off the wall and fall right to the floor, and they're not going anywhere, and God's as silent as a tomb, and, you know, things going from bad to worse, and where are you in this mess? You know? And but what does it say here? I have heard your prayers. I have seen your tears. Behold, I will heal you. God has, you know, his purposes, his reasons for, you know, doing things in our life. I mean, we don't have answers for. But what does the Bible say? All things work together for good for those who love the Lord, are called according to his purpose. Now, that's easy to quote, right? But if you just quote it, it sounds really flippant. It sounds flippant to me, especially if you're going through some very deep waters. Mm-hmm. But if you really believe with all your heart, saying, you know what? This doesn't make any sense to me at all. Not at all. But you know what? I'm going to trust God in it anyway. Look what Jesus said. Jesus said when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, he said, you know, he was begging his father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me, but not my will, but thy will be done. You know, I've heard people say, and I think I've read in various books where people say they're kind of into the, you know, I don't know, name it and claim it crowd. You know what I mean? They just say that, you know, if you just have enough faith, anything is possible. You know, the kind of the health, wealth, and prosperity crowd. Well, they've come out and said stuff like, well, if you pray and saying, well, Lord, let your will be done, it shows a lack of faith. And I'm thinking, you know what? It's just the opposite. Just the total opposite. Because if you really are going through some very difficult times and you look at the situation, you say, you know what? If I could change this, if I could change this myself, I would definitely change it in this way or this fashion. But if you stood back and say, you know what? I have the power to change that. But knowing in your heart, hey, I want God's will. Mm-hmm. I want God's will. That's the most important thing. I don't know how many times I've prayed in my life, Lord, you know exactly what I want in this situation, exactly what I'm praying for, but what I'm mostly praying for, let your perfect will be done. Mm-hmm. If your perfect will is done, then I can have a peace about it. Even if I'm profoundly disappointed mm-hmm. about it, I can have a peace about it if your will is done. Now, to me, that's the highest form of prayer. It really is when you are seeking God's will. In other words, what you're saying, in essence, is this: Lord, I trust you completely, totally, explicitly. I trust you so much that regardless of what happens, I want your will. Now, does that honor God? Does that glorify God? Does that show tremendous faith? That doesn't show a lack of faith. Yet people say if you pray it that way, you're showing a lack of faith. I say just the opposite. If you really want God's will in your life. So he's sitting here and he says in that verse 5, he says, "Return and say to Hezekiah, the leader of my people, thus saith the Lord, the God of your father, I have heard your prayer. I have seen your tears. Behold, I will heal you. On the third day you shall go up to the house of the Lord. I will add 15 years to your life, and I will deliver you in this city from the hand of the king of Assyria, and I will defend this city for my own sake and for my servant's sake." So, you know, you get the impression here when you read this verse that right around the same time all this was coming down in terms of the threat by Sennacherib, that Hezekiah gets sick. It's right around the same time. What's the old adage? When it rains, it pours. Or I mean, that's what I have. I should have a T-shirt that says that, because I tell you, they say bad things come in three. I think it's 33. I don't know. It's just one thing after another. You know what I'm saying? Well, you know, this poor guy, he's getting slapped upside the head with one thing after another. And God says, "Look, I'm going to add 15 years of life. I'm going to heal you, and I'm going to take care of this whole situation for you." Then it says in verse 7, "Then Isaiah said, take a cake of figs," and they took it and they laid it on a boil and he recovered. Now, you wonder, what the heck, what did he have? I don't know. I really don't. And I read it in Josephus and it said he has distemper, and I looked up distemper in a dictionary and it said something like a viral infection of a dog. And I said, what the heck did this guy have? And he says here he had a boil on it, and I don't know, but I know this. When it comes to healing, this is out of Catholic Bible, so I hope some of you guys don't be offended by this. But, you know, hey, there's a book in here it's called the Sirach, and it's otherwise known as the Book of Ecclesiasticus. It's not, don't confuse it with Ecclesiastes. But, you know, there's a lot of wisdom in this, because it says in this Book of Sirach, it says, "Hold the physician in honor, for he is essential to you, and God it was who established his profession. For from God the doctor has his wisdom, and the king provides his substance. His knowledge makes the doctor distinguished and gives him access to those in authority. God makes the earth yield its healing herbs, which the prudent man should not neglect. Was not the water sweetened by a twig that men might learn its power?" We read that in Exodus, where God, the waters were bitter, the waters of Marah, and God had him throw a tree into the water and made it sweet. That tree represented the cross of Christ. It says, "He endowed men with the knowledge of glory in his mighty works, through which the doctor eases pain and the druggist prepares his medicines. Thus God's creative work continues without cease in its efficiency on the surface of the earth. My son, when you are ill, delay not, but pray to God, who will heal you. Flee wickedness, let your hands be just, cleanse your heart of every sin. Offer your sweet-smelling oblations and petition, a rich offering according to your means. Then give the doctor his place, lest he leave, for you need him too. There are times that give him an advantage, and he too beseeches God, that his diagnosis may be correct and his treatment bring about a cure. Who is a sinner towards his maker will be defiant towards the doctor." Now, the reason I even shared that is because there is a number of people today, a growing number of people who say, hey man, you shouldn't go to a doctor, you shouldn't take medicine, you shouldn't, because it shows a lack of faith or whatever, right?
Interesting.
And I'm saying, no, I don't believe that for one minute. Look at Luke. He was a physician, right? He wrote the book of Luke. I mean, God's given us herbs. He's given us medicine. He's given us these type of things for people's healings. All right? But who's the real healer? So in other words, it was saying there, we need to seek God in prayer about healing. And at the same time, I wouldn't take your medicine and throw it out the window, saying, well, God's healed me. Well, unless he really has healed you, see what I'm saying? And I just kind of want to throw that in there because I read this about putting this kind of ointment on something, some kind of inflammation that he had. But it wasn't really the medicine that healed him. I think it was in conjunction with what God was doing in his life. All right, but why would this be in there? You know, God could have waved his hand over the guy and healed him. But look at how many different ways Jesus Christ healed people in the Bible. I mean, look at how he healed various blind people. One guy, he just heals by his word. Another guy comes up and he makes spittle on the ground and puts it on his eyes and said, go wash in the pool of Siloam. Another guy comes to him, he's deaf and he's dumb, and Jesus spits on his tongue. And you wonder, why? Why did he do that? I mean, he could just say the word. But you see, he meets each and every person where they're at individually. And in other words, one blind man could go up to another blind man and say, you know, Jesus healed me of my blindness. He said, oh, really? He healed me too? How did he heal you? Well, he healed me by putting spittle on my eyes. He says, well, you can't be healed. You can't be seen. That's not the way he does things, because he healed me by just speaking the word. That was Bartimaeus, right? You see what I'm saying? A lot of people could say, well, you know, that's not the way God works. Well, wait a minute. God's sovereign. He can work any way he wants to work. You can't just put him in a box or dissect him in a classroom and say, if you haven't been saved the way God saved me, then you can't be saved. You know what I'm saying? You've been healed the way God healed me. What I'm saying, God works all kinds of ways for his glory, for his honor. And this is a way that he worked through Isaiah the prophet, and he worked through this medicine, right? And the guy is healed. But now look what he says here. Verse 8, now Hezekiah said to Isaiah, what will be the sign that the Lord will heal me, that I shall go up to the house of the Lord? Now he's asking for a sign. And you can say to yourself, well, what the heck? The guy's asking for a sign. Does that show a lack of faith? Well, remember a couple, few chapters back, and we were reading about Hezekiah's father, Ahaz. What happened in that situation? You had a situation where you had the Syrians came down, and the northern kingdom came down. They invaded the southern tribe. Then Ahaz, the king, even though God was punishing him and disciplining him and trying to bring him back to him, God was going to deal with these people coming against him. And this is what God said to Ahaz, because I think it's profound what God said to him. In verse 6 of chapter 7 of Isaiah, it says, let us go against Judah and terrorize it and make for ourselves a breach in its walls, and then set up the son of Tabeel as a king in the midst of it. Thus saith the Lord God, it shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. For the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Now within another 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered, so it is no longer a people. And the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. If you will not believe, you shall surely not last. Now listen to what he says. Then the Lord spoke to Ahaz. Now Ahaz is Hezekiah's father. Okay? Ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Make it deep as Sheol or high as heaven. In other words, ask whatever you want. As deep as hell, as high as heaven. Whatever sign you want to show that I mean business here. Now look what Ahaz says. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. Now that sounds pretty pious, doesn't it? But it really is a lack of belief, because Ahaz says, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. Then he said, listen now, O house of David, is it too slight a thing for you to try the patience of men, that you will try the patience of my God as well? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with a child and bear a son, and he'll call his name Emmanuel. He will eat curds and honey at that time. He knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. For before the boy knows enough to refuse evil and choose good, the land of whose two kings you dread will be forsaken. Look at that prophecy. Isaiah said, ask for a sign. Ahaz says, well, I'm not going to ask for a sign. He said, well, fine, I'll give you a sign. A virgin shall be with child, and you shall call his name Emmanuel. Who's he talking about?
Oh, Jesus.
This was a prophecy made about 750 years before Christ was born, right? That a virgin would have a child, and you call his name Emmanuel. What does Emmanuel mean?
God with us.
Look at that amazing thing. So the reason I even bring this up is because you would wonder, how come Hezekiah asked for a sign? Well, he obviously knew about this situation with his father, and he figured, well, what sign are you going to give me? What happened in Matthew 12, where it says that some of the scribes and the Pharisees said to him, teacher, we want to see a sign from you. All right? But he, Jesus, answered and said to them, an evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign, and yet no sign will be given to it but the sign of Jonah the prophet. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a sea monster, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will stand up in this generation at the judgment and will condemn it because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and behold, something is greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south will rise up with this generation at the judgment and will condemn it because she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, something greater is Solomon than here. So the reason I even share that is that in Jesus' time, the people were asking for a sign, and he rebuked them. Mm-hmm. All right? Yeah. Isaiah told Ahaz to ask for a sign, and Ahaz said, I won't ask for a sign, and he gets rebuked. And so here we got Ahaz's son Hezekiah asked for a sign, and God gives him a sign, and you talk about a big sign, he gives him a big sign. So what happened? Well, these guys in Jesus' day are asking for a sign, but Jesus rebukes them. Why? Because they were seeing all kinds of signs. Jesus Christ was raising the dead and giving sight to the blind and hearing to the deaf, and people were able to speak. The dumb were speaking, and he was doing everything. So what kind of sign would they want? They want the sun to dance in the sky? Even if Christ did that, they wouldn't believe him. Right. So he said, this is an evil and adulterous generation that's asking for a sign, because you see the signs all around you. Okay? So when you get a situation here where God said to Ahaz, well, ask for a sign. He doesn't ask for a sign. Well, he's not believing. Right? Mm-hmm. So he gets rebuked, and God says, okay, I'll give you a sign. A virgin's going to be born. I mean, it's a ho! A child will be born to a virgin.
Oh, virgin born.
My head is just going too far.
Virgin born every night.
Right.
Exactly. Virgin born every night.
Right. Yeah. That's what. See what's happening to me.
Getting old.
Yeah. So now the big sign here.
Okay. Right. So you guys see where I'm coming from, anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway. So what I'm saying is this: look at the sign that he asked for. All right. He said in verse 9. Says Isaiah said, "This shall be the sign to you from the Lord, that the Lord will do the thing that you have spoken. Shall the shadow go forward 10 steps or back 10 steps? So Hezekiah said, it is easy for the shadow to decline 10 steps. No, but let the shadow turn backward 10 steps. And Isaiah the prophet cried to the Lord, and he brought the shadow of the stairway back 10 steps by which he had gone down on the stairway of Ahaz. Now he's talking about the sundial here. Mm-hmm. All right. Whether it was a stairway that they used as a type of sundial,
yeah.
Okay, or whether it was a sundial itself, it was to go back 10 degrees. All right. Now this is really phenomenal to me. It's absolutely phenomenal that this miracle. Because you got to ask, what took place here? When we went through the book of Joshua, in Joshua chapter 10, we read there a situation where God's enemies were in mortal conflict with God's people. And Joshua just knew, hey, look, if the sun goes down, we've all had it. Our enemies are going to be able to regroup, and they're going to come back on us. So, you know, what did Joshua say? He said there in Joshua chapter 10, he said, then Joshua spoke to the Lord in a day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the sons of Israel, and said in the sight of Israel, O sun, stand still at Gibeah, O moon in the valley of Aijalon. So the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation avenged themselves on their enemies. Is it not written in the book of Jasher that the sun stopped in the middle of the sky and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's what happened in Joshua for a whole day. And this is even a more phenomenal miracle, because even though this takes place in about 20 minutes, what's happened here? You got a situation where, what did God do? Did he just stop the entire movement of the cosmos? And then in this situation, did he just reverse it all? I mean, this is really mind-boggling, okay? Because you get a situation where we set our watches by the stars,
yeah. Yeah.
By the planets, by everything in this movement. And you see the power of God here? You see the power? When God says, ask for a sign, make it as high as heaven or as deep as hell. Ask for a sign. God can do anything. Our Earth, our planet, is hurling through space at 67,000 miles an hour. We're rotating on our axis at 1,000 miles an hour. I mean, if you're driving in a car 67,000 miles an hour and you stop on a dime, the kinetic energy is going to send you through next week. I mean, you're going to go through the windshield. You're going to keep going. You're going to go to the moon, right? But he stops everything. Everything stopped in its place. That's what it looks like happens here, right? And nobody feels a thing. And not only did that happen in Joshua, now here, everything's reversed.
And you wonder, did he just reverse the entire cosmos? Did he just reverse everything? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's been speculated all over the board what happened here, because nobody really knows exactly what happened. And I know that there was an article that was written many, many years ago. It was in the Tarabella News. And as a matter of fact, there was a book that I read. It was called How to Live Like a King's Kid. And there was a book out called Joshua's Longest Day by Dr. C.H. Todden. And there was a book called The Bible and Modern Science. And they all said basically that, I got the article right here, I'm not going to read it, but they said basically that the men of NASA were trying to calculate the movements of the stars and the planets, and because every time they send up a satellite or something out there, they got to know exactly where everything's supposed to be, because if they don't plan it just right, they can collide with anything out there. Okay, long story short, they came up with all this about having a missing day in all their computers. They couldn't find it. They went back and they couldn't find it. And then somebody said, well, you can find it in Joshua, you can find it in here, and they found the missing day. Well, that never made quite sense to me. That doesn't make any sense. And it never did, even though I read it in three different accounts, all right? And I had it brought up on the Internet, and they talk about this very thing, that all it is a legend. It's an urban legend. Because it says, can the event that took place in Joshua 10:13 be confirmed? And it says, according to the laws of physics, there's only two possible explanations for having the sun stand still in the sky for a day. The earth would essentially have to stop spinning on its axis, for which there is no evidence. And two, the sun would have to start moving about in the solar system in a very specific way so that it appeared to us on our spinning earth to be standing still. There is no evidence of this occurring either. We too have heard of the urban legend about scientists at NASA finding the missing day, quote unquote, in the computer calculations of the motions of the planets. The legend has been around for longer than NASA itself, but turned into a NASA event sometime in the 60s. The story goes that some scientists were doing orbital mechanic calculations to determine the positions of the planets in the future for use in determining the trajectories of the future satellite missions. They realized that they were off by a day. A biblical scholar in their lot remembered the passage from Joshua, and all was set right. But these events, in fact, never occurred, and it's easy to understand why. And the reason why it's easy to understand why is because all the calculations are based upon the present, not the past. Okay? So I just share that with you because I know that maybe some Christians will bring it up, but you got to know that, hey, you know what? That's a legend. Okay? That's not true. But I still look at this and I say, I believe what God did is he reversed the motion of everything. And nobody felt a thing. People, they can make mistakes by trying to, you know, come up with these stories, these myths. And it makes Christians look stupid, doesn't it? The whole thing discredits the whole thing.
Right.
So what I'm saying is I just share that because I read it in three different accounts, all right, about this missing day and about this whole situation with NASA. And it never sat well with me because it doesn't make any sense to me. And sure enough, it was a legend. And I just share that because you don't need that. You just look at this, and you know what this is saying? What did God do here? This is the most incredible miracle you read in the Bible. When he not only stopped everything dead in his tracks, and nobody felt a thing, but here he reversed everything. And it says here 10 degrees, which apparently is 20 minutes. It may be 40 minutes, but yeah. I think it's 20 minutes. Does anybody's Bible say 20?
I had 40. I don't know
40 minutes? Well, it could be 40 minutes. I don't know how they had that sundial set up. But we're talking about 40 minutes. I mean, it was Isaiah who says, well, it's nothing for the shadow to go forward. You know, it's nothing for time to go forward. Have it go backwards. Man, that's a miracle. Hezekiah prayed to Isaiah, and Isaiah prayed to God, and God answered his prayer. But you look at that miracle.
Yeah.
I mean, is that phenomenal or what? Look at the God that we're dealing with here. This is my point. There's nothing he can't do.
Right.
Nothing he can't do. Anyway, let's just wind this down. Verse 12, it says, at the time, Berodach Baldan, the son of Baldan, the king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he heard that Hezekiah had been sick. And Hezekiah listened to them and showed them all his treasured house, the silver and the gold and the spices and the precious oils and the house of his armor and all that was found in his treasuries. There was nothing in his house nor in all of his dominion that Hezekiah did not show to them. Now, where did Hezekiah get all this wealth? Because we read he gave it all away to the king of Assyria, including the gold and the doors, right?
He got it back.
He got it all back. Yeah. got it all back. So, you know, now he's really wealthy. He not only got back everything that he gave to the king of Assyria, but he got all the king of Assyria's spoils back. So now he's really wealthy. And verse 14, then Isaiah the prophet came to King Hezekiah and said to him, what did these men say, and from where have they come to you? And Hezekiah said, they have come from a far country, from Babylon. And he said, what have they seen in your house? So Hezekiah answered, they have seen all that is in my house. There is nothing among my treasuries that I have not shown them. Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and all that your fathers have laid up in store to this day will be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. Some of your sons who shall issue from you, whom you will beget, will be taken away, and they will become officials in the palace of the king of Babylon. Then Hezekiah said to Isaiah, the word of the Lord which you have spoken is good. For he thought, is it not so if there will be peace and truth in my days? Now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah and all his might and how he made the pool and the conduit and brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Judah? So Hezekiah slept with his fathers, and Manasseh his son became king in his place. Now, this just ends on kind of a sour note, in the sense that once Hezekiah became well, and he, you know, the king of Assyria was defeated, and this Assyria was just such a threat to everybody, that all of a sudden Hezekiah now becomes a legend in his own time. He becomes very famous because all these surrounding nations have, you know, have a great deal of respect and reverence for him, because they figure he defeated the army of the Assyrians. And so Babylon sends a delegation of people down there. And what does Hezekiah do? He's intoxicated with all this, all this attention and everything. And so he starts showing them all of his treasure. Look at all my wealth. Look at all that I've got. That was a big mistake. Because Isaiah approaches him on that, and he kind of mildly rebukes him on that. Basically saying that, well, you know, you see all this wealth, you see all this stuff you got, it's all going to be carried away to Babylon. Because what happened? Like I said, you look at this situation here, the northern kingdom, they already went into captivity because of their wickedness. But God spared the southern kingdom because of his servant David, and because these people weren't as wicked. But when their cup of iniquity began to overflow, then God says, okay, you've had it too. And he throws them out of the land. So he says, this is what's going to happen to them. The northern kingdoms went to Assyria. They were scattered all over the place. The southern kingdom is going to go to Babylon. Why? Because God's no respecter of persons. All right? It's like when a nation's cup of iniquity begins to overflow, then it's time for judgment. How far along do you think we are?
Yeah.
You know what? I mean, God is long-suffering. He's patient. He's merciful. But I'm telling you, he's not mocked. People deceive themselves to think that, hey, we can just go on sinning and giving him a collective middle finger and keep going on this road. And he's been trying to get our attention for the longest time. You know, this is what he did to the northern kingdom and then to the southern kingdom. He constantly would send one warning after another, after another, after another. And people were just so stubborn, so obstinate, they would not listen to God. Is that where we're at today?
Mm-hmm.
So God's going to say, this is what's going to happen to the southern kingdom. But Hezekiah feels to himself, well, you know, at least there'll be peace in my day. Okay, now he didn't want to see this happen, but he figured, well, God will give me peace in my day. So what happens then? He says, then he dies. But look at the way it's worded here. You know, it says here in verse 21, so Hezekiah slept with his fathers. You know what? The Bible always uses the word sleep to denote what? To denote death.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I was mentioning the other night when Jesus Christ went in to heal Jairus' daughter. There was a bunch of paid professional mourners out there weeping, whining, crying, carrying on. And Jesus said, hey, knock it off, man. She's just asleep. What did they do? They all mocked him.
Laughed.
And he had them all put out of the house. And he goes in with Peter, James, and John. He says, Talitha Kum, our little girl, rise. You know, he raises her from the dead. But what did he say? She's asleep. Jesus says in John chapter 11, he says, hey, Jesus said this, I'm the resurrection and life. And there's coming a day when everyone who are in their graves are going to hear my voice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that profound? That is absolutely mind-boggling. Because I don't care if you've been turned to dust. I don't care if you've been cremated. I don't care if you've been eaten by sharks.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to hear the voice of the Son of God. Like he said, Lazarus, come forth. He's going to say, my people, come forth. And he's going to say, ye wicked, come forth. Everybody's going to hear his voice. That's astounding, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when people try to put Jesus Christ on the same level as everybody else, man, they don't know what they're talking about. There's no comparison between Jesus Christ or Buddha or Muhammad or Confucius or anybody else you can think of. Jesus Christ said the most outrageous things. You know, he did. And he's either a lunatic, a raving lunatic, or he's God Almighty, because there is no in-between. He didn't leave us with that option. When he says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, nobody comes to the Father except through me. Hey, what other option is there? I didn't say it. You think I'd say that? I'd say, hey, get them all in. Let the devils in. It doesn't matter to me. He said it. You're not getting to heaven except through me. Now, is that profound?
Yeah.
You know, imagine if any other person said it. Imagine if I said that. I mean, you say, you guys got a screw loose. Right? You just don't go around saying these kind of things. You know, and say, well, he's basically a good person. No, you're crazy. You're insane. You're the biggest liar, deceiver, con man that ever lived, ever walked this planet. Look at what he said. It says here, Hezekiah slept. That's the word it uses.
Mm-hmm.
When you see a person in a coffin, they're just asleep. As far as God is concerned, they're going to awake. The big question is, are they going to awake to a resurrection of everlasting life? Or are they going to awake to eternal damnation? Mm-hmm. Now, believe me, their soul is still conscious. We're not talking about soul sleep here. When a person dies, their soul either goes to be with the Lord or goes to hell. You know? But their bodies are going to hear his voice, and their souls are going to be reunited with their bodies, and they're going to be part of the resurrection of the righteous or the resurrection of the damned. Yeah. That is heavy. You cannot, you know, can you think of a more heavy thing to you know, really reflect upon in life? Because it all boils down to what we're here for, what we're made for, what life's all about, what's meaning, what's purpose. Does anybody have anyone to add or share?